this the part where I start talking?
Yeah.
This part right here. This is the part you were referencing, like the music faded, like you said.
And then you start talking.
That's the new intro. Now, did I technically fuck up the new intro by asking you this on the show? Or
you know who truly fucked up the new intro is Travis.
Well, that's
because he just loaded this up and I had to, you know, play like, all right, I hope this works.
Right.
And
but it worked.
I think it did.
I think it was solid.
Yep.
Let me tell you what else is solid.
What is?
Big Body Cisco's in the house.
What?
Yep. Hey. Yep.
What's going on, everybody? Yep. Yeah. We here. We are here with John Orlando on the Action Junkies podcast.
I like that.
See, that was like a little commercial for you.
That
Action Junkies podcast.
Yeah, that was good. You have radio voice. I was saying that before we started.
And it's weird because I can't turn it off. So even when I'll be yelling at my kids and they'll be like, it sounds like we're on the radio getting yelled at. So
how many kids do you have?
I have 5 kids.
Whoa.
Yes. Yes.
What ages?
They range from 24 all the way down to 1.
Wait, hold on. Time.
Yeah,
out.
I got a lot of baby mamas too. So I have like numerous kids
that
I claim.
How do you have 24?
Yeah, I have a 24-year-old.
I'm trying to do math here and figure out.
I was in probably 12? Junior high when I had.
Yeah, like what the hell? Like this guy was bagging it at 12? Like what?
I said, I'm not going to learn about the birds and the bees, mom. I was going to go right at it.
Right. He's like, practice.
Oh, we got to wear a condom? I didn't know that. Shit. Got a baby. Okay.
That's kind of cool though, being like a young.
I'm the cool young dad.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it's a blessing because fatherhood is the only hood I represent nowadays. So it's good.
The 24-year-old is a boy or girl?
Boy. So I got 4 boys, 1 girl.
Okay. So that's good.
Yeah.
How old's the girl?
She's 1. She's my youngest.
Oh, the young one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you have some time before you have to be stressed out.
You know, because I had all boys up until that. Uh-huh. And then it was just like, okay, you have a girl now.
Right.
Because when the boys are easy.
Right.
It's when you have the girl, it's like, okay, damn. You think about all the shit you did to girls, like, damn, and I actually got a girl.
You're like, here comes payback.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Wow. Well, thanks for doing this, man.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Cool. You were, before we started rolling, you mentioned so many things that were cool.
Yeah, see?
Dwayne the dog bounty hunter.
My buddy, Dwayne Dog Chapman.
Yeah.
And the reason why you won't see, because I was on an episode of his.
Yeah.
And it is crazy because people in the Midwest and people in Las Vegas, when it happened, they were like, oh, he was on Dog the Bounty Hunter. And I actually sued the dog. And so that's why they don't have the episode no more. Because I didn't sign the release form.
Yeah.
So I have voicemails from dogs saying, hey, brother, they love you in Samoa. And I'm like, that's so racist. I'm from the Bay Area. So, I had, you know, messages from him, you know, trying to get me to sign this release. Never signed the release. Long story short, I sued him and they could never show the episode. So he used this episode as the world premiere episode. It was a 2-part episode.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And they had me in there and they came to our football practice and Leland tried to grab me. And then I was like known for like pushing Leland. I was like, get off me. And it was like, you know, everyone's used to him being in Hawaii, you know, punking all the Hawaiian, you know, dope fiends.
Right.
And he came to our football practice and they didn't show like he had like 30 cops behind him. So he kind of like showed up on there and they're like, oh, they thought they were trying to get somebody else. And it was like a mistaken identity.
Oh, okay. I was just going to ask you.
No, yeah.
Okay.
You're looking at me like, damn, did you do time? So they were actually
even though it was mistaken identity. You didn't even want it out there so people could be even confused.
Well, I didn't want it there at all because, you know, it was just bad at the time. You know, when we were actually watching Dog the Bounty Hunter, and we should see it.
Right.
And, you know, if you want to be betrayed as the victim or the guy that's, you know, going to be there, that was like, okay, yeah,
right.
I can't do that. So I was telling my mom and them, I was like, dude, he came to our football practice and they had laid me down in numerous places. They came to a nightclub and laid me down, gunpoint.
No way.
They came to our gym, to the 24-hour fitness. I was playing basketball, laid us down, gunpoint. And that's why I was like, okay, this is a guys. First of all, it's not me. You know, I'm 6'5", I'm like 300 pounds. They're looking for a guy that's 5'8". And I'm like, guys, I'm not the guy.
Right.
So long story short, we messages from him and, you know, his wife just passed away, you know, rest in peace to his wife. Voice messages from her. Oh, you got to sign the release. So I was like, yeah, there's no way in hell. But they showed the episode. And they showed the episode.
They showed it without you signing it?
Without our consent.
Oh, wow.
Showed the episode. And it was the world premiere one. So it was like their season, you know, premiere.
Sure.
And, you know, everywhere in the grocery store, it was like, hey, were you on Dog the Bounty Hunter? And it's crazy. Because, you know, all the trailer park out there, I was like the dude. It was like, he's the dude that kind of pushed Leland out of the way. And it's a crazy story to this day. Because now that I do these shows, Leland comes to the thing. He's like, hey, he was like, oh, shit, let's go.
So you sue him, you sue the network, you sue everyone.
So I sue, but I'm just, because if you Google my name, that'll be the first thing that comes up.
Really?
That, you know, Cisco sues Dog the Bounty Hunter.
And you won, I would imagine.
Yeah, you know, we won, but then I think the stipulation that we won, we couldn't talk about it.
Got
you know what I mean? Or we couldn't talk into detail.
Right.
Everyone kind of knew what was going on from the paper, but It was like, yeah.
Did they end up settling, or they you had to actually go?
No, they ended up settling.
They ended up settling.
Yeah, so okay. They ended up settling, and of course, well, you know, good. I was a young kid at then, yeah. So all that's gone. So
okay, but it was good while.
But it was good. But I got the recognition, so it was crazy because in Las Vegas, I would come visit. I live here now.
Yeah.
But I would come visit from the Bay Area, and all the security guys, all the Polynesian guys. Oh, that's Cisco from Dog. I'm talking VIP
really?
Service, bottle service. They rolled out the red carpet every time we came.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a good time. Even now to this day, you'll have like a straight middle-aged white dude overall. He's like, hey, you was on Dog the Bounty Hunter. I was like, yeah, you're a man.
Oh, my God.
Take
I love
a picture
it.
With me and my wife. I was like, all right, cool, let's do it. So, yeah.
When did you move here?
I moved here 2 years ago during the pandemic.
Okay.
So just recently, I'm still new to the Las Vegas area, and I moved from the Bay Area, San Francisco, California.
It's great, though, isn't it?
I love it. Except this butthole devil heat that we got going
it's
on
bad.
Right now.
It's bad. This last 10 days been rough.
But when I moved out here, it was 120 degrees. So ooh. We were about to turn the U-Haul around. I was like, yeah, this is bullshit. I ain't doing
right.
this. But now you kind of, they say, oh, you get used to it. Absolutely not.
Oh, no?
No.
Well, I got used to it in a sense. I told Vanessa, my girlfriend, I don't know if you've met Vanessa, yeah. the pint-sized warrior. Have you met her
I
yet?
Haven't.
Okay. She's 5 feet tall claiming, or she's really 4'11 and a half claiming 5 feet.
Oh, wow. So she's like in heels, she's 5 feet. Okay, yeah, there. Yeah. You got to do that.
I told her like a couple weeks ago, it was like 102,
yeah.
and I was like, it's not that hot.
Yeah, yeah, like that aspect, yes.
Right.
But when it starts passing 105
oh,
and
forget
111
it.
And yeah. you outside, it's you're like a rotisserie chicken. I'm just like rolling around.
It's bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I first moved here 5 years ago, I moved here June 30th, and it was like 115.
Right in the middle of it. Yeah, me
same
too.
Thing.
I moved in August,
I was in the U-Haul,
and it was like
and I was
right
like,
there.
I don't know about this.
So you've been here for 5 years then?
Been here for 5 years, and yeah. when I moved here, I was living in an apartment at first for the first few years.
Yeah.
And when I looked at the models, like before I, you know, yeah. pulled the trigger, the model was like on the second floor and we just walked up a staircase, you know? So, and then the apartment I had was on the third floor, the one I actually yeah. rented. So when I pulled the U-Haul up, I was looking for the elevator. I'm like, trying to find the elevator over there in Green Valley. Yeah. And I'm like, where is the elevator? And I called the leasing agent. And I was like, hey, I have a dumb question. I can't find the elevator. And
so oh, there's
like,
no elevators.
There's no elevators. Yeah. I'm like, what? I'm like, I never would have committed to yeah, the third floor.
Absolutely.
No way. Oh,
yeah, I'm on the first floor because they did the same thing to me. They said, oh, you want to move up to the? I was like, nah, you yeah. ain't got no elevators in here. I'm going to the first floor.
Yeah. And the yeah. move, the we I had some buddies moving me, you know, in the U-Haul.
Yeah.
That drove, and they were like, about the money. Yeah, they're like,
well, it's gonna be cool, but now that we gotta walk all these stairs,
there's gonna be a heat tax. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So I had to pay a heat tax.
Oh, you can't do that.
Yeah. Mm-mm.
Yeah.
Do you like it here though?
I love it here. I yeah. love it. I mean, Bay Area is my home. I love the Bay Area, but I would never go back there because it's like $3,000 for a broom closet.
I hear
you.
So,
you know, with everything so expensive out there, you know, I got a lot of family out there, but when I moved to Las Vegas, it was like, wow, it's so much stress-free, I'll
yeah.
put it that way.
Yeah.
A lot of less stress out here. And you know, the only thing besides the heat, you got to stay away from the casinos and you're good.
Right.
Because once you go to casinos and start playing and then you just start thinking you're going to win all the time, yeah, that can definitely...
They're going to get you.
They're going to swallow yeah. you up.
Do you
House
like
always
to play?
Wins. I do. You know, I dabble here and there. I'll go to South Point every now and then, play some poker, but I'll never go to the big poker rooms.
Right.
I found out that the South Point poker room is like the convalescent home of where they play poker at. So I'm sitting there with all these old dudes. I'm like, hey, yeah. old ass dudes up in here.
Yeah.
But I just go there, have play for fun. I don't yeah. really sit there and kind of say, I have to go play.
Do you play tournaments or just cash
I do.
Games?
I've been playing a couple of tournaments.
Really?
I do like a $60 buy.
Yeah, they have good nightly tournaments yeah. over there. Yeah, yeah, I play over there sometimes.
So I go to the 1 o'clock one or the 6 o'clock one or the 10 o'clock
yeah.
one and just kind of test my, you know, and I always feel good when I get into like the bottom two or the top 20.
Sure. Yeah.
Like, okay, cool.
Yeah.
Like, cool. The winner's going to win $632. Like, cool. Thanks.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's a good time.
If you
there.
Get that far, you can win. I
yeah.
mean, it's, there's not that much difference between
yeah.
20th and first. You
and
know?
It's crazy because a good friend is Phil Ivey.
Okay.
So my cousin, he's Phil Ivey's bodyguard.
Really?
So when we go to Phil Ivey's house, I'm kind of like, okay. You know, let me try to learn how to play poker from this dude. Doesn't really give no secrets out.
Yeah.
But, you know, being around Phil Ivey, you kind of think, okay, if I'm around Phil, I can
yeah.
play some poker.
Yeah.
Absolutely not.
Yeah, he
not
is. He's definitely one of the GOATs. I mean,
yeah.
I love watching him on TV. He's so good. His stone cold.
Oh, his poker face
that
is.
That face, man,
oh, yeah.
is the same no matter what.
I always wondered if that poker face was the same, like, during sex or, like, anything else that he does. I was like, oh, did you really still have that face? Did
right.
you come, babe?
Yeah.
Just have that stone cold face. Like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
Phil's a motherfucker, you know?
Yeah. He likes to gamble, too,
yes,
though. Like,
that's a gamble.
He's no stranger to craps.
He is a gambling
and baccarat
dude.
And, yeah. Yeah. Yeah,
in his
that.
House, he has like full size tables. You know,
really
like the craft, because you know, that's where he practices his craft.
Yeah,
but it's like it's you know just kind of see somebody focus on what they do for a living.
Yeah,
kind of makes you say, okay, I got to start stepping my game up.
Yeah, I played in a lot of like bigger tournaments over the last few years.
Yeah,
I've always
did
been
the World
like
Series
a
of Poker.
Yeah, okay. yeah, and I played in the main event the last
yeah.
few years, And it's a lot of stress, man, those tournaments, you know. And, you know, even the smaller ones like at South Point, it's stressful because you want to win.
Exactly.
And every decision you make, you know.
And you don't realize, because I'm still of a novice player, so, like, the littlest mistakes can, you know, swallow you up.
Yeah, and not being able to keep your composure after making mistakes if you are still in, you know, if it doesn't cost you the tournament and you're still in, it's hard to, at least for me.
Yeah.
That's my hardest part is I go on tilt like that, man. Like, I just get mad, like.
And I'll sit here and I'll think I can intimidate some of the older guys. They'll be all in. And they'll call me like, shit.
Yeah. That's one thing I've learned. Like, those old, like, Vietnam vets and stuff, they're not fucking around. Like,
they don't give a damn about
your poker
face.
They have it.
Exactly.
And same thing with, like, I feel like women. I have this rule, like, in my head. Like, women don't bluff because they like to buy shoes and bags.
Oh, at South Point, too, they got all the black widows over there. They got the older Asian ladies that are just sucking the money out of you.
Yeah, yeah.
If they start talking to you all nicely, it's like, nah, don't talk to me. You done took all my goddamn money.
Yep.
So, yeah, I don't really – I try to stay away from them and talk to them.
Yeah. And then the other problem I have at South Point playing is it's not that far from the movie theater. It's just up the escalator. And the smell of freshly popped popcorn fucks with my head.
It gets you right.
And you're not allowed to eat in there yet.
Exactly.
Right?
Not until the poker room. So I actually been to the bingo hall. Like, I would never thought I'd play bingo.
Yeah.
So, you know, older Polynesian ladies, they love bingo, you know. So I was like, all right, let me try bingo one time. First time I go there, me and my girlfriends are over there, and then I say, oh, she bingoed like $15.
Yeah.
So I'm like, all right. So I say, oh, bingo. You know, my machine goes off. The lady comes by. I'm thinking I won $15, $20. She goes, you know how much you won? And I was like, no. She goes, you won $10,000. I was like, wait, what?
What?
And she goes, yeah, you got the blackout within under 54 numbers or whatever it was. And I was like, no way. She goes, oh, do you have your ID? I was like, wait. I won $10,000 on bingo? And she was like, yeah. I was like, okay.
And didn't even know it.
Didn't even know it. I thought I won $15, and I'm sitting there. I was like, okay. So she's sitting there cashing out $10,000. I was like, oh, I love Vegas.
Wow. At the South Point.
South Point bingo.
Holy shit. Yeah.
It's crazy. So now I'm like, I go in every now and then, you know, when family goes, you guys want to go to bingo? They're like, no, we're going to go to craps. Like, oh, we should go to bingo.
Yeah.
Because it gives you that vibe, like you're going to win it again.
Right.
And, you know, that's definitely not the case. Because when you win $10,000, you know, you just don't give it back to the house.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like that. You have to definitely have to be careful living in Vegas.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
And now, do you have lots of friends like I do that visit all the time and they want you? Well, you have a crazy job. So we should say, for those that don't know, you're a DJ.
Yeah. So I'm a DJ. So I do a lot of entertainment things. So we're in the entertainment industry as well. Yeah. So I have a lot of friends who are already out here that moved out here 20 years ago from the Bay Area.
Yeah.
You know, DJ Friends, and he's like the resident DJ at Dre's. And all my DJs that are friends out here, like DJ E-Rock, Romeo Reyes, they're doing all these clubs. And they were kind of like saying, hey, I heard you're thinking about moving to Vegas. Do it.
Yeah.
And I was like, all right. You know, when you're at hometown, you don't kind of want to take that step.
Right.
And it kind of took them kind of saying, bro, watch when you move out here. Just come out here for a little bit. You'll see. So, because I'm thinking it's always going to be like the Strip.
Right. It's thinking it's everyone always part of it.
Yeah. So when I actually got out here, I was like, dude, stay away from the Strip. Yeah.
You can go weeks living unless you have friends coming in town that drag you to the Strip.
And when I used to come to Vegas, so my cousin KT that lives out here, we used to always, whenever we go to Vegas, we say, hey, make sure you get us into the club. Like, whoever lived in Vegas, we thought they had the hookup everywhere.
Right.
So I never kind of got it, because every time I would get mad, hey, you can't get me in this club.
Right.
Now that I live here,
right,
I'm the guy that everyone thinks I own Vegas and I run Vegas.
Yeah.
So anytime family and friends come in town, they're like, hey, you can get us in here? I'm like, absolutely not.
Yeah.
I know nobody over there.
Yeah.
Plus, Vegas is trying to make their money back from the pandemic, so they're not giving no hookups.
Yeah. It's definitely tougher than it used to be.
Yeah.
But it's a lot of pressure, right? When you have friends come in, I feel it all the time.
They think you can take them everywhere in Vegas.
Right.
And I'm just like, yeah, guys, go have fun. Right. I'll hook up with you guys for dinner, and that's about it.
Yeah.
But they want you to go do the long drinking, go to Dre's after hours, and I'm like, yeah.
Or do they ask you any hotel hookups?
Oh, all the time.
And it's hookups. Never during the week.
No, it's during the weekend.
It's like Memorial Day
July 4th weekend.
Yeah, they're like, hey.
So I had just did an event at the Sahara.
Yeah.
At the Azillo Pool. We did a July 3rd with Comic Kings. We had them as guests. But, you know, it's the busiest week. One of the busiest weekends in Las Vegas.
Right.
Everybody's coming to the show. Hey, I need a hotel hookup.
Yeah.
I need tickets. Like, all this stuff. I'm like, it's July 4th weekend.
Right.
It's UFC fight weekend.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah. So you start learning these things, fight weekend. Now that the Raiders are out here, you got football. And so now that we have all that, it's like, dude, everyone that lives in Vegas, they think we can get them anywhere. And that's definitely
not
the
case. I tell my friends, come the week after the 4th.
Come on Wednesday.
Come the week after Labor Day. Come like the week after New Year's. Like,
come on Tuesday through Thursday and you'll be good. Yeah.
Then let's talk. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
You mentioned UFC. You're a UFC fan.
I'm a UFC fan. So a lot of friends in UFC, Bantu Iwasa. You know, we had Tyson Pedro on the show. But, you know, we always support our Polynesian fighters.
Yeah.
And, you know, we just... as growing up as Polynesians, you know, you always fight. But when you see them in something that's structured like the UFC,
yeah.
it's kind of a little bit better to cheer for
yeah.
because it's not just an alleyway that they're right. just doing some shit at. So when you have like people like Bam and, you know, Mark Hunt and all yeah. these people that were growing up watching Ray Seffo, you were watching them growing up as kids.
Yeah.
And David Toole, when he was a boxer, when he fought yeah. Lennox Lewis, those were like our idols, our sports idols.
Right.
You know, as opposed to the football players that played there, but these were like individual sports.
Yeah.
This is something that wasn't part of a team. You've seen David Tua go against for the right. heavyweight championship. You've seen Ray Seffo, Mark Hunt, Bam.
Ray fought Kimbo, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So I've definitely been a fan since then, and now that it's flourishing, Vegas is the place to be.
It really is.
So, and you know, we're right behind the UFC Apex, yep. and just I went over there for, the UFC holiday party when Kid Rock was over there.
Oh,
and because we're good friends with Kid Rock, with Booyah Tribe that we had. So okay. go over there. I'm inside the UFC Apex. It's the first time I've ever been in there.
Oh.
And I'm looking around. Dana White's over there getting hammered. And I'm just sitting yeah. there. I'm like, dude, this is dope.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's just like the culture of the UFC
yeah.
being there.
Have but, you yeah. seen a fight over there yet?
I haven't. Not at the Apex, but I've seen the fight at the T-Mobile. T-Mobile. Arena. Yeah.
So at the end of this month,
yeah.
Tuesday night, Dana White Tuesday night contender series starts.
At the Apex.
Wow. Every Tuesday for like, I want to say like 12 or 16 yeah. weeks or something crazy. And it's guys trying to fight their way into the UFC.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The contender.
We have to go. I go every single Tuesday. It's unbelievable.
It's like we have contender growing up. It's just your cousins you got to get
right.
by.
Like,
I'll fight him. And yeah. I got to get to the boss. But yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, UFC's a big UFC fan.
Yeah, it's fun. It's better. It's weird. You know, boxing... And when it's not the main event,
yeah.
right? If you go to boxing, you go see Floyd, that's cool, or back yeah. in the day, Tyson, whatever. But the prelims, no one ever really cared yeah. about unless you know the
exactly.
someone fighting.
You know the fighter.
UFC, I feel like, maybe I'm just biased because yeah. I'm a fan, but like I feel like you could sit there and watch guys you yeah. don't know.
Because you never used to watch the preliminary boxing right. matches. They're like, okay.
You skip them.
Yeah, give me one the first two before the one goes on there. But now,
right.
the preliminaries are sometimes better than the main events.
100%.
And you know, you talk about the fight of the night, and I'm just like, we were talking about Brad Tavares.
Yeah.
He had a fight.
That was a war.
And that was a war that they did. And that yeah, wasn't even on the main card. I went to that fight. Yeah, see?
Yeah.
And so shout out Brad too, man. Dope fighter out yeah. of Hawaii. But just kind of like, you know, being in Vegas, you rub shoulders with all these fighters.
Yeah.
And you kind of see, you know, what they go through. Then you get the fighters that come from New Zealand
yep.
and Australia.
Man, they got some badasses, they got some coming badasses down under.
So just kind of seeing the whole culture of the UFC fight game kind of, you know, grow into what it is now.
Yeah.
It's crazy because on the flip side of that, I have to take Mark Hunt's whole thing. You know about that.
Yeah.
So Mark Hunt's whole, you know, we talked about him being against Dana White and everything.
Yeah.
That kind of opened my eyes too. Because mm-hmm. I was like, man, you know, Mark has a point. He's the only one that kind of spoke out about everything.
Right.
And that I just see these fighters. After I see Max Holloway get that big gash in his eye, it's like these guys are definitely risking their lives.
Yeah, for sure.
And now, you know, and I'm looking at Dana, not in a different way, but it's a business at the end of the day.
Right.
But it's like these dudes are whooping ass and they're only getting paid whatever they're getting paid.
Right.
And, you know, when Mark Hunt was trying to say in his whole spiel, I was like, these fighters do deserve a little bit more money.
Yeah, it's tough. I get it. I see both sides yeah. too. You know, it's like it is a business. And I feel like the ones that move the needle, like yeah. the Conor McGregors, the Ronda yeah. Rouseys, they seem to, you don't hear
be
them complaining,
care of.
Right?
Yeah, exactly, because they're taken care of.
Yeah, so it's like a weird, and, you know, I don't know what the solution is. I think it's like, yeah. They've talked about like a fighter's union.
Yeah, they're trying to talk about,
would help, but they can't seem to get it done. Position.
If I'm a fighter, I'm like, okay, if I'm going to fight tooth and nail and go balls out, I kind of want to be, you know, compensated for what
right.
it is. And I don't really know the logistics of what these fighters do get paid,
right.
but if you're not one of the cash cows like McGregor or yeah. Rousey, what do you get?
Yeah.
And then do you have to have these incentives? Like, okay,
right.
you knock somebody out, you have this, you know, knockout bonus. So
right.
it's all a business at the end of the day.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, you kind of listen to some of these fighters like Mark Hunt that's
yeah.
not getting the publicity that he's not getting. You
right.
know what I mean? So
right.
And you look at these fights in a different light.
Man, Mark Hunt knocked some guys out cold.
Oh, man.
In
Mark
his
Hunt,
day.
He's knocked out people like not even in the ring, like outside the ring as well.
Seriously, yeah. You're a big guy. Did you ever fight like or so, think about fighting?
You
or?
Know what? I fought, but it was always like, at the club or outside.
Got
but,
it.
You know, and we don't go out there looking for fights. You know,
right.
the stigma about Polynesians, we're just big.
Right.
And we're security guards and all this thing, but it's like we're the nicest people, we're raised with respect.
Yeah.
It's the people that are drunk that want to test. Oh, let me go fight the
right.
big guy.
Which is crazy that that is a thing because people would look at you like I look
yeah.
at you and be like, why would you want to fuck with him?
Yeah.
But there is a food group of people.
Oh, yeah.
That
especially with UFC.
They get liquid courage.
There was a time when everyone in a tap out shirt was trying to fight all the Polynesians because they wanted to think, you know, test their tap outness.
Right.
And it was just like, yeah, please don't do it.
Yeah.
Please, I really don't want to do it. And then we end up knocking them out. And they're like, see, now I look like the bad guy.
Yeah.
But you was over here with a tap out shirt talking about, let's scrap. I'm like, yeah. okay.
Did you see the story? I think this was in 2020. There was a Polynesian girl. I want to say she lived in Hawaii. Don't quote me where she lived. But she worked at Target, I think. Target or Walmart.
Buy. I think it was Best Buy.
Okay, Best Buy,
yes.
You're right.
Yes,
so you know what
story.
I'm talking about.
Yes.
And someone was trying to steal some shit, and she like...
She was
a
like
big
old
girl.
Lineman. She was
and
like playing
she
guard.
She knocked the guy down, wasn't having it. And Dana hired her.
Yeah, as a security guard.
And I think she still works
still
there.
Over there. Yeah. And it's because, you know, I mean, we're respectful people, but like when we have a job like that,
right?
Me personally, I'm like, okay, you know, if it was like she was stealing some
why
headphones.
Why risk your life?
Why risk it? But you're raised in something that you're... It's like, you know, family oriented.
Right and wrong.
The work is like your family.
Yep.
And you know, the Polynesian lady was like, oh no, this is my family.
That's her house right there. Yeah.
For my family. And she showed it.
Yeah.
You know, you wouldn't get the passion in some other security guards.
No way.
That she had. And I think Dana's seen that and the world's seen it because, you know, with viral videos going around nowadays, you see that. And like, okay, now you want to know what her backstory is. But that was dope.
It's such a great story and it's such a good lesson, I think, because like you never know what the future holds for you. I mean, that girl was doing it just because it was the right thing to do in her eyes, and it led to a whole new life. And like,
You can tell she had some brothers that she dealt with when she was growing up too, because her stance was there, and she had them pinned up against the wall. Like, go on, get them, mama.
Yeah.
Because all these stigmas with being Polynesian, comes with the stereotypes of course of everything. But if you really dive into it, the way I was raised in the States. And when you're raised in the islands, it's a little bit different, you know. But when you're raised out here, you kind of still raised with the same values, the respect, you know, respect your elders. And, you know, it sucks because, you know, when you do that, people already see me and have this, oh, okay, he probably is going to be a bully or intimidated by us because we're big.
Yeah.
Really, if you really sit down, a lot of people that I know that even in Vegas, because this being the ninth island, they're like, dude, they're the nicest people.
Yeah.
And I was like, dude, we're nice until you guys, you know, take us over that edge. Yeah. But it's like, under that, we've been raised to kind of sit there and make sure everybody's fed.
Yeah.
Make sure, hey, if you come to the barbecue, we'll make sure everybody's, you know, eating and all that.
Yeah.
But then once you start getting outside of that and start testing it and be like, oh, you want to fight? Oh, God, here
we
go.
Here we go. Yeah. It's funny how the stereotypes exist. I mean, because people look at you, a big guy, and the ink, they might think, oh, it's you're sending a message or whatever. And it's like most of the UFC, actually all the fighters that I know, they're all nice, calm. They're not talking
We're the
shit.
Nicest guys. Man. Yeah. I was on a plane and this little kid was like, Mom, look, he has tattoos like Moana. And you know, I was like, okay, that's a little racist, but that's cool. The kid don't know. And she goes, oh, can we take a picture? You look like, you know, the movie. Right. And I'm just like, yeah, that's fine. And it's crazy because it's so, you know, the kid was so innocent in doing it. But I was like, okay, that was probably not the best thing to say. But I'll go ahead and take this picture with this kid. Yeah.
And so you travel a lot for work, too.
Yeah, I travel a lot. And I've been blessed to actually, you know, I do shows. So I do island reggae shows. In my demographic, where I've been traveling to New Zealand, Australia, Fiji, Tahiti, just on the music stuff. So with the artists that are out there, I'm a DJ that DJs before the artists come out. Mm-hmm. So I kind of get the crowd ready for everybody and kind of sit there and kind of just go back and forth with the crowd, which I've kind of like made a living out of.
Yeah.
Because I've seen it when I was growing up that all these shows that I was going to, I was like, dude, how come there's no entertainment in between the acts?
Yeah.
So I'm the in-between guy.
It is cool. You know, I'm friends with Russell Peters,
yeah.
comedian, you know, and he's got different opening acts and stuff, but he brings a DJ with him too.
He's a big DJ aficionado. He's a DJ himself.
Yeah, yeah.
And Russell always has a good DJ. He has a you know, friendships with a lot of DJs from the Bay Area as well. Shortcut, a lot of people that we know. And that when he has that in-between, that whole buildup makes it that much better for
100%.
When Russell comes on.
It really does. And in between acts sometimes.
And that's what I do. So I get paid for, I go on tour with these guys and say, hey, I need you to do that before, you know, all of our shows.
Yeah.
And at first it wasn't a respected, you know, position.
Right.
So I kind of had to make people realize, okay, look how I do it and then go to the show without me doing it.
Yeah.
And then let me see how you like
it. It's a big difference, man.
Huge difference.
Yeah.
So after that, they were just like, okay, name your price. What are you charging for this?
It's amazing just the difference. Like if you go into like a store in the mall or something, the difference of playing like Muzak where it's just fade in, fade out.
Exactly.
As opposed to mixed.
It's all about the
where
vibe.
Where it's seamless transitions. Yes. Like seamless transitions is everything.
And you, when you do that, you kind of have a different experience. You know, and my whole thing is about building the experience for the concert goer. For the festival goer. It's like, look, if you're just sitting there and then some random guy, oh, okay, here comes such and such.
Right.
I'm there to have a good time, make these people feel, you know, like they spent the money right.
Right.
And all these artists that I work with, they kind of say, dude, it usually takes us 3 to 4 songs in to get that energy up there.
Right.
It's already there when we're done because you're introducing us and the vibe is already ready.
At the fights, it's a big difference.
Oh, yeah.
At the UFC fights,
huge.
They got that DJ that's been there forever. I forget the guy's name. But, you know, he's in between fights. It keeps that
music
energy.
Is everything. And I keep telling people that, especially for events, like weddings, any like major events, if the music isn't right, the whole vibe is different.
Yeah.
And I think that that's so important for like DJs coming up to know that we're a big part of big events.
Right.
So stop taking these crumbs
right.
that you guys are doing, because you guys have to realize, look, we're the vibe.
Right.
So when I do weddings and I do like private events, they're like, oh, what do you charge? Like a couple hundred? I'm like, nah, it's pretty up there.
Right.
And they're like, well, what are you talking about? You're just a DJ. You know, you don't take the disrespect. You kind of tell them, okay, well, do it without me.
Right.
And then we'll see how it is.
Right.
And then you see the difference, because I say you get what you pay for.
Yeah.
You pay that $150
DJ.
It's
not an iPod playlist.
Exactly. And the iPod playlist, you're searching right. for songs. You know, we're curators at the end of the day.
Right.
So we're cute. I always look for somebody in the crowd that.
And you're doing it in real time.
In real time.
Right.
So, and you're doing it right there. You say, okay, I need to make sure that table or these people are having a good time. And I'll play a certain song. And it's crazy the language you can speak with just music.
Yeah.
You'll play an old school R&B song. You'll play a Luther Vandross or something. And somebody like, oh, what you know about that, youngster? You know what I mean? And you get that reaction. You play that, and I kind of go across the whole room and the whole spectrum and see how these people are having a good time. And it's all in the music.
So how rough was 2020 for you then?
It wasn't as rough as you would think. It actually was a blessing for a lot of us DJs, because we went to Twitch.
Uh-huh.
And everything was virtual. We was at the house.
It forced you to really go all in on.
And it really exposed DJs who didn't have personalities. Mm-hmm. It really exposed people that didn't really know what they were doing. They weren't hiding behind a DJ booth.
Yeah.
And for us, you know, a lot of us DJ friends and as well has said, hey, there's this thing called Twitch that we thought it was a video game platform. Yeah. That they say, hey, there's a loophole, because we're doing it on Instagram Live, we're doing it on Facebook Live, but they kept cutting us off for the copyright content. We're like, dude, we might as well stop doing it. So not being discouraged, just like, what could we do? Twitch, who's based in San Francisco, was like, hey, we play music on video games. This could be a place where you guys could actually do this.
Right.
So we started doing that. Pandemic shut down, and we're just sitting there. I'm going to YouTube University, how to kind of make the production value of what we're doing at home. You know, at first it was just kind of background like this.
Sure.
Now we're doing the green screens. Now we're doing all this stuff, and it was like making an experience. And now I have fans all over the world that tune in every Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, which the days I'm on. And I'm like, that's crazy, because I built a whole community of people that were just stuck at home.
Yeah.
And now they're watching my shows, and all those other DJs were like, dude, it's crazy. Because now you get paid for it.
Yeah.
Now you can monetize it.
You mentioned a lot of DJs that you're friendly with.
Yeah.
Is that the norm of the DJ community, like very supportive, or is it very like cutthroat or
it can
competitive?
Be. It's like in anything, when you have a group of people that's passionate about the same thing, they kind of like, you know, get together, they kind of gel together. The whole thing that's ugly about it, you start to get the competitiveness.
Right.
Is, oh, I'm a better DJ. So I always tell people, look, I'm not the best DJ, but I know how to put some songs together. Uh-huh. You get these real technical DJs that'll sit there and scratch, oh, you can't do this? You're right, I can do that. But I'll tell you for sure, I could do a 10,000 people person crowd and make sure they're having a good vibe.
Right.
So it gets kind of competitive there, but like, you know, some people will be jealous of somebody that can play on the strip. Mm-hmm. You know, oh, how come he's playing on the strip? Because the opportunity was there.
Yeah.
But as a collective and as DJs, you kind of just always have respect for each other. Say, look, your grind might be better than his grind. That's why he got that opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for the love of music, it shows. You know, in Vegas, it was always known to me as be the EDM place. You always had to know what EDM was. And, you know, we kind of, Franzen had this thing called No EDM.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, when we used to come to Vegas, hey, where's the clubs that doesn't play EDM?
Right.
So they're like the only club that was strictly hip hop that Dre's, that he started maybe 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah.
That he was actually banned from the strip to playing hip hop.
Really?
And, you know, they were like, oh, it's only EDM. So we kind of, he took it upon himself to say, dude, I won't play no clubs unless it's hip hop. And he stuck to his guns.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Dre's kind of noticed that. People started to notice that. I was okay. He never plays EDM.
Wow.
And it's crazy, because that's like a six-figure check for EDM DJs.
Sure.
You know, people also ask me, too, hey, would you ever play be an EDM DJ? I couldn't do it because that's not me.
Mm-hmm.
There could people be like, oh, I put a few EDM songs together and do it. But I just, for me as a passion and what we do, I wouldn't want to fake it either. I wouldn't want to sit there and be like, oh, yeah, look at Big Body Cisco, the EDM DJ. Never in a million years.
Right.
But I could play some good R&B. I could play some good island reggae, good hip-hop.
Yeah.
And that's what I think, personally, since I moved here, is missing on the strip.
Yeah.
Because it's so EDM, because these entertainment directors, oh, it has to be 80% EDM and maybe 15 or 20% of what you want to do.
Right.
That I'm noticing.
But back in the day, they used to do different nights, right? Like here in town.
Different themes.
Even, right.
Yeah.
Hip, you know, even 80s rock, you know, hip hop, whatever, sometimes top 40 night, you know.
Yeah. And everyone had their
trance,
like, nights.
Trance was
to do
big
it.
Back then,
but now
after hours.
EDM is just
now it's just
over.
EDM.
Yeah.
Unless
you're at Dre's,
maybe Marquee has a...
Marquee, and I think like some hotel like Daylight, like where E-Rock and some of them are, they'll play some more hip-hop than usual, but it's still predominantly you know, EDM.
Why? And it's just because it's just follow the leader? Or it's just laziness on the
Even when I used to visit
directors?
Out here, I used to call it music. What's that? I was like, I can't stand that shit. But it's like, you know, to each his own. They have a market for it. They have so many people that love it. They have these big EDM carnivals, the EDC or whatever they call it. But it's like, it's a billion-dollar business right now. So, of course, people are going to draw to that because of the popularity of it.
Yeah.
But, like, I'm from the old school. I'm like, if I got a good vibe, because I'm telling these pool parties, you know, you go to Encore Beach Club, you go to Tao, it's like all like EDM.
Right.
I said, dude, if we do this with some island reggae, you trip how the vibe would change.
Right.
But who's going to buy bottle service during an island reggae set? Who's going to buy? They want that whole thing where right now it's bottle service driven. So it's like, okay, which cabana is buying the most bottles?
Right.
And normally it's the people that want to listen to EDM.
Right.
So, yeah.
Could you sneak some stuff in, though?
Then there's some DJs that cleverly sneak some stuff in there to the EDM, and they do it. And these EDM DJs are starting to take, you know, they'll take an island reggae singer or a reggae singer and go put them on an EDM track.
Yeah.
And they just put that EDM version of it with them on it.
Right.
So it's clever, but it's like we still know you kind of, you know, cater to the EDM crowd.
What is it like when you get outside of Vegas? Is it the same thing all over the country right now?
No. It depends on where you go. So, like, where I tour at, like, in New Zealand, Australia, there's a huge island reggae demographic where, you know, but there's also Jamaican reggae, too. I was talking about it with some of my guests that I had on the podcast, where there's a difference because Jamaicans call, you know, Hawaiian reggae, Jawaiian reggae. You know, it's just the guys from Hawaii because they were so happy with the reggae. But reggae is really depressing. If you listen to some of like the Bob Marley.
Right.
So like they were like, okay, oh, they do happy reggae. We do the real reggae. So I'm just like, hey guys, I just like good music. You know what I mean? And I've always been about, I kind of pride myself on feel good music. Whatever music you can feel good to is something that I play. And I've kind of like coined that term wherever I go. I was like, hey, what kind of DJ? I'm a feel good music DJ.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, what does that mean? Music you can feel good to.
Yeah.
And then you kind of start seeing people start using that moniker. And I was like, okay, he knows what he's talking about. Like any song like UB40 or some of these songs that you like, even from old school, you know, Shy Lights, you know, Manhattans.
Yeah.
And I was just listening to Sarah Smile from Hall & Oates. Those are songs that make me feel good.
Right.
And I let my kids start listening to this mumble rap, and I'm like, what the hell? I turned into my dad instantly.
Right.
Turn that shit off. You know what I mean? And I never in a million years thought I would be that dad.
Yeah.
But I'm like sitting there like, you know, oh, that's Kodak Black. I don't give a damn who it is.
Right.
I thought it was a Kodak camera. I'm the old guy now.
Yeah.
But it's like music has always been big in my upbringing because my parents brought us up on that.
When you go to like Australia and places like that, and now you're from Vegas, is that a cool thing to them? Like, oh, he's from Vegas?
Because they expect me to do Vegas things.
Got
you know what I mean? So when I'm out there, it's like, oh, you're going to play EDM because you're in Vegas? Absolutely not.
Right.
We're still going to stick to it. I said in Vegas, now that I'm out there, it's feel good music in Vegas.
Yeah.
So when I go there, they're expecting, oh, he's probably going to play some EDM. And I'll play the same thing. And it's kind of just, oh, he's just Vegas, but it's not the EDM Vegas.
Yeah. Now, do you produce your own music?
I don't. I let the producers produce.
Got it.
Let the artists be the artists. And I just kind of sit there and curate everything. Mm-hmm. You know, I dabble in singing. When I was growing up, you know, I was in the church. I was probably one of the best tenors in the church. It's debatable for some. But, I always like to sing. I was watching my mom and dad when we drive from L.A. to San Francisco.
Yep.
They would do the duets.
Yep.
And I was always a huge, big music fan. So I was, like, always there. But I never wanted to be the producer. I never wanted to be the artist. I mean, there was a time in my life where I wanted to be a rapper. Everyone has that once. Oh, I could be a rapper.
Right.
But growing up, you kind of say, okay, let me just kind of do what I'm good at. Once you kind of just put the passion in what you're passionate about, you start to see stuff start opening up for you.
When did you know, okay, this is what I'm going to do, that I'm going to be a DJ?
I was in Hawaii. And so I always wanted to be a DJ, but I could never afford the DJ equipment.
Mm.
You know, the techniques, you know, all
CDJs,
the
CDJs.
So I was like, man, that's it. So I would, you know, tell my parents, hey, can we get some? They're like, absolutely not. So I was over making my own mixes with the cassette tapes, you know, taping the top of the cassettes and making my own from the radio. So I was like, okay, I can't be a DJ. What can I do in the game? I love music. So I knew music all my life.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Hawaii one time and I seen this guy's name was B-Cat. He stood next to the DJ and was just on the mic. Mm. And he was, you know, kind of going, he knew the songs, he knew the breaks, and he was kind of getting the crowd. I was like, oh shit. I said, okay, what's this aspect of it? I was like, oh, he's just talking shit on the mic. I was like, nah, there's kind of an art to this. So he turned the music down and had the crowd sing it, and it was going back and forth with him. I said, okay, he's on some other shit.
Uh-huh.
So I said, I went up to him. I said, hey, bro, what's your name? He was like, oh, BK. He's like, I rock the parties. I'm not a DJ. I said, so what do you do? He's like, I'm an MC. I was like, okay, cool. I said, you mind if I try that? He was just on the spot.
Yeah.
World Cafe in Hawaii. I get on there and I'm hooked. I come back to San Francisco. All the DJs are kind of DJing. I go, hey, where's the mic at? And they're like, oh, well, it's over there. I'll get the mic and I'll start rocking next to him. They're like, oh, shit. So promoters started to notice that, hey, we need you at our next party.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, cool. So I'm sitting there with DJ Quick and all these big DJs that are coming to San Francisco.
Yep.
And I'm just on, whether they liked it or not.
Right.
Hey, where's the mic? Hey, Cisco wants the mic. Hide the mic from him.
See, this is where it's an advantage to be as big as you.
Exactly. So that's the one time that I pushed it around because I was like, hey, where's the mic? They're like, it's over there. I was like, I need the mic. And I was getting real adamant about this. This was my Hennessy days, too. So Hennessy was a little aggressive. Like, where's the goddamn mic?
You went Hennessy out of the bottle.
Exactly.
Too. I walked around with it.
Mm-hmm. So once I started doing the parties, I was the party. I was the life of the party.
Yeah.
And the DJs was kind of like, okay, he's kind of taking the shine from us. I was like, nah, if we do it you know, together, right, this could be a dope thing.
Yeah.
So some of the DJs was on board with it. Some of them weren't. Yep. So when they see me come to the party, like, hey, hide the mic. Cisco's coming. And there was other DJs that, hey, man, come to my, I'll pay you to come to my DJ set and do what you do. So DJs were kind of paying me a couple hundred, you know, getting me a bottle of liquor, and I was just doing it.
Yeah.
At first, I was doing it for free. Then promoter was like, hey, how much do you charge to do that? And I was like, I never thought about it as being a living. And I was like, oh, let me talk to my manager. Don't have a manager.
I love it.
And they were like, I was like, email my manager. They were like, okay, big body's manager at Gmail. And so they email that, and it's just going to me.
Genius.
And I'm just sitting there like, oh, yeah, Cisco will do it for 500. Make sure he has this.
Yeah.
And then it started to get more. Hey, we need you at this club. We need you at this club. And I was like, okay, I found myself on the weekend, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, I was doing clubs.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh, shit, this could really be, you know, something. Because nobody was really doing it like that.
Yeah.
You've had a few DJs that could talk and DJ at the same time, but you had the ones that couldn't talk that I was kind of picking up the slack for them.
Yep.
So when I started doing that, there was a show, like a concert, that came to the Bay Area. And I was like, oh, let me do it before the concert.
Yeah.
So I kind of went up there and was doing it. So I cut the middleman out because some of these DJs were hating. And I was like, no, let me learn how to be a DJ. Now it's a little bit easier. You have the controllers now. It's a little bit easier. You don't got to lug all these records.
Yeah.
You had them all on the laptop. I said, let me cut the middleman out, become a DJ myself, kind of teach myself. I wasn't being a technical DJ with it's all, you know, turntablism and all that, which is nothing from them, but I was a party guy. So I went to my first show. Jay Bug came over there. He was like, hey, come bring me out. You know, just kind of just saying, bring me out. So I did like a 10-minute set before he came out. Played all the music that I knew these people, because we were in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
Played all this Bay Area music, and the party was going.
Yeah.
Party was going. The performer was like, hey, we need that. The manager of the artist was like, hey, can you come on the road with us? I was like, shit, yeah, let's do it. How much do you charge? You got a manager? Yeah. Let me give you that email. So I started doing that, and it just started getting bigger and bigger. And started doing more shows. And I started going on the road. I was like actually on the tour buses.
Really?
I was like, okay, I'm actually part of the show. So there, you know, there's record labels saying, hey, we're going to go on this tour. How much you charge to do a 10-city tour? Let me talk to my manager.
Yeah. I love it. This.
So I made my own pricing because I didn't want to sell myself short as well.
Yeah.
I was kind of like doing my research. Oh, how much does a DJ get paid?
Right.
You know, I was like, hey, well, how much do you get paid to do that show? He kind of told me, okay. Then I go to another DJ. How much do you get paid to do that show? Because there was no price on what I was doing.
Right.
So I took...
You created a category.
Created my own lane.
Yeah.
And I stayed in my own lane by saying, okay, when I started seeing other people start to be MCs, started to like introduce an act, hey, how much do you charge to do it? Like, dude, come, I don't mind teaching you because I want you guys to get right. But if you're doing it for free, that makes me look like an asshole if I'm charging $2,000-$3,000 to do it.
Right.
So I said, dude, stop doing these things for free. You kind of built a name for yourself.
Yeah. It's funny how a lot of people are driven by fear, though.
Yes.
And they'd rather ask for free, say, I'll do it for free, than put a number to it out of fear of the rejection.
Because I've done a lot of free shows.
Yeah.
But then people thought I was dumb. Hey, do it for, you'll get good exposure. That was the big thing, exposure.
Right.
You'll have good exposure. I was like, okay, I can't pay my rent with exposure.
Right.
I got mouths to feed. I can't feed my kids with exposure. And I would tell people that. Hey, you could do a few shows for free, but once you know that you've kind of mastered your craft, say, look, I can't do exposure.
Right.
This is the price. Either you take it or you don't.
Yep.
I had to turn down a lot of shows that I would normally do because I wanted to be on that show.
Yep.
And I wanted to be on that festival. And the festival, we don't have a budget for what you do.
Were there any times where you like priced yourself out because the number you gave them was too high?
Oh, yeah.
They were just like,
so no. So being my own manager,
I was
bad guy, good guy.
Yep.
So I would tell him, my manager will hit you back. Hey, your manager hit me with $5,000. Right. I was like, dude, I'll do it for $2,500. It's cool. I'll tell him.
Uh-huh.
So at that point, what they were paying for was like, okay, you do it for $2,500. Right. I said, yeah, just let me know and I'll tell them. And then I was like, okay, so $25 is the meeting what they would pay.
Yep.
Then I would know for this promoter. So this other promoter, I'll say, okay, hey, the manager put $6,000, but I could do it for $3,000. Okay, yeah, thank God, because I wasn't paying that $6,000, but you would pay $3,000.
Uh-huh.
The more I did that, the more I started, you know, showing everybody's ass at that point, because now I started to make my own lane.
Yeah.
Now I was sitting there, I was like, hey, how much you get paid? $5,000? I was like, yeah, but if you can't, I'll tell my manager, you know, he put $8,000 on the thing. I was like, dude, I'll do it for $5. And it was a drug thing at that time. I'm over there making my own prices.
That's great.
So I just kind of said, and everyone was watching, hey, how do you get that much for what you do? I said, because
you gotta have a manager.
Finally got a manager, and he was just like, you know, he was a good friend of mine. He was my business partner. He was like, dude, how do I? I said, you're the bad guy. Remember, managers got to be the bad guy.
For sure.
They take no shit.
Yeah.
I said, remember, I always have to be the good guy. He's like, hey, you know what? Let me talk to the manager.
Yeah.
So everyone hated my manager.
Right.
Hey, fuck that guy. He was charging me, you know, all this money.
Right.
But I told him, take that into your own thing, because if I really had a manager, like these artists, so the artists who had managers, I was asking them. hey, how do you manage, you know, doing this? I'm just an asshole. I just tell them this is what it is. Mm-hmm. And I'll go tell manager, hey, you got to tell them this is what it is.
Yep.
And so, you know, I had a manager for a couple of years, and I was like, it worked out, but I was doing fine by doing the dark managing.
Sure.
So I kind of got away from having a manager and just kind of every time there's somebody, hey, can I get your manager? Yeah, I'll get you his number. Or I'll get you his, I'll get you his email. So.
And you already knew how to work the system. So the value that the manager's bringing for the 10 to 20%
exactly.
is not worth
it. So I was like, wait, the 20%, I can just keep that and just keep doing it dark.
Right.
And just say, then it'd be, so, hey, where's your manager? We want to meet him. Yeah. Ah, you know, he's busy. He's busy.
He's on tour. Yeah,
he has three other people that he's representing right now.
You can even complain about him. Exactly. Ah, he's neglecting me.
And I was like, what? I'm about to fire him. You know what I mean? So you can use that whole, you know, ghost of a manager to kind of like position yourself into where you want to do and what you want. So
That's an awesome story.
Yeah, and I tell it to the kids nowadays too. They kept saying, hey, do I need a manager? I said, dude, you're your manager.
Right.
Manage yourself first before you, I mean, I'm not saying not to have a manager because there's managers out there that do this.
For sure.
But I always say if the manager is not as passionate as what you do, you know, how you are, then how could they get me what I want?
Right.
So I always say get you a manager who's your biggest fan and knows what you do and knows what you're passionate about. That's going to be the guy that gets you what you deserve.
Right.
Because a lot of these managers are working just for that 20%. And I would just kind of say, hey, you're, as a manager, you're supposed to be getting me shows. You know, these people are asking me and I'm giving it to you. You're supposed to be getting me shows. You're kind of just sitting here, you know, getting all the shows that are already coming in. A manager is going to sit there and go out and say, hey, I know this dude, Cisco. He would be perfect for this show. That's what a good manager would do.
You mentioned something earlier that there's so many young DJs, the new guys can't even relate to, which was hauling around crates of records and then at one point, crates of CDs even.
I'm talking about you had the CD
crates.
Books. You had the crates of the records.
Crates
you had
like of records, a, right? The books.
You
the
had CD. A dolly if it was a good party. You had all these crates of records. And these kids, you know, even when I carry my laptop around now, even my son's like, Dad, where's all this? Let me get your laptop. I was like, dude. And I go back to my dad. You know, back in the day, we had to lug these crates of, you know, records. So it's definitely
and
easier.
And finding it. You had to request
you had to sit
it,
there.
It,
and while a song's going on, you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah, I can't get this in for the next one.
It's so much easier now. You just kind of just search the name.
Right.
It pops right up, and you get it right on. So these kids got it easy right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, they're not taking advantage of it because I think what these kids are doing, they're spoiled. I think this generation's spoiled where they do have so much easier access than we did.
Yeah.
They have Instagram to promote their parties.
Yeah.
Back in the day, we had to make hard flyers.
Yeah.
We had to make paper flyers.
You mentioned mixtapes was a thing, handing out the
mixtapes. We had to do mixtapes. Oh, who are you? And now that they have social media to get their brand and get their name out there, it's so much easier. And I'm like, well, you guys are being lazy, but you guys are not using these tools that you could be doing to its advantage.
Is Serato still something that you guys use?
Serato's still around,
too. So how is the like, I have a couple DJ friends, like, that transition for them was scary. Like, fuck, like, Serato? Like, I'm just...
I started seeing my friends transfer to Serato, they were kind of like saying, okay, no, we don't want to do Serato. That's the newer DJ.
Right.
Then I was like, look, guys, swallow your fucking pride. Put the ego to the side and learn this shit because this is going to be, you know, you have to adapt to what's going to be there for the normal for tomorrow.
Yeah.
So a lot of these DJs kind of, like, refused it at first. And I was like, guys, if you guys don't learn it, these younger guys are going to learn it and take your gigs.
Yeah.
So I would learn it right now. So a lot of the DJs now, they're like, okay, they kind of bit the bullet on it. Like, let me learn it. And now they're building Serato into the mixers. They're building Serato into the CDJs.
Right.
And all. So they're making it easier. Yeah. But of course, you get that older DJ who's like, oh, you're not a real DJ. That's fine. Now, because I adapted to what I'm doing, I don't have to sit there and lug the record and do all this. But they have the older DJs that were, you know, built in that.
Now, I saw some posts on Instagram like a month ago. Is vinyl kind of coming back? Like
vinyl's
cool,
like the cool thing.
Cool
so,
retro.
So, you know, they had, you know, Jogging Wheels, what they have now, where you could put vinyl on there. It's like a Serato vinyl.
Right.
And that people are using. But now, like,
I think
artists,
it was Russell, maybe. I think I saw Russell.
Russell
using
was doing
vinyl.
It on vinyl.
Okay.
So, some of the controllers are building now, they kind of have like a little vinyl aspect to it. But now it's just kind of like cool for like new artists that come out with music to come out with a vinyl album. To be that's kind of like it's exclusive. Like, what is? Because the kids are like, what is this?
Right.
Even when I talk in my verbiage, it's like, man, you know, this is this new album. They're like, what's an album?
Right.
Like, oh, okay, the new download or the new stream or whatever. So you kind of got to adapt to that. But it's like, you have to adapt with the changes and adapt with the times.
Yeah.
And a lot of the people that don't and are stuck back in the old days, they're going to be exactly there, back in the old days.
Now, do you see yourself doing this for how long? Is this?
No. So I've done this for almost 15, I want to say going on 16, 17 years, but I told myself that with this podcast that I'm doing now, the Western Conference podcast that I do here at Sticky Paul Studio, that's kind of my lane now.
Yep.
I have about a year or two left in touring and doing shows, doing live shows, doing concerts. And then after that, I want to just focus on my podcast and focus on the one festival that I'm going to do for myself. And then I'm going to take that festival and kind of take it to Hawaii, take it to all these places, and just focus on those two things.
Yeah.
I think the older you get, the more you realize, like, look, let these kids do all this stuff.
Yeah.
Go ahead and find something that you're passionate about, which this podcast I am,
yeah,
and this festival I am, and kind of just take all your experiences.
Where is the festival?
The festival would be based in the Bay Area first. Then I would do it here in Vegas because I'm here in Vegas now.
Yeah.
But I'm so used to the Bay Area still. You kind of want to do it at home.
And you probably
first.
Have a loyal following.
Yeah, and I have a loyal following there. So we used to do a thing called Island Reggae Festival 10 years in a row. And then the producer of that had just passed away during the pandemic. You know, rest in peace to Danny Perez. But after seeing that, it was like, okay, we could do our own festivals. Because I go here to Vegas, too. I go to Day in Vegas. I go to, you know, all these Life is Beautifuls and kind of just see production value-wise, you know, how it is to run it. It's not easy.
Right.
So that's why when we did that one for 9 years in the Bay Area, I was like, okay, we could do one day. You know, they got these festivals that are 4 or 5 days.
Right.
So I do festivals and also in the Bay called Cali Roots. They do 4 days now. It used to be 3 days in Monterey, California. But I take from all these festivals that I worked at and kind of say, okay, I could do my own festival. First, people would say, what's taking you so long to do your own festival?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, you don't want to do it. You know, you don't want to rush it, first of all.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, you don't know how to do it.
Yeah.
I want to kind of sit there.
Too.
It's a lot. You have to have a team that knows what they're doing because I can't do everything myself.
Right.
And I'm so used to that because, you know, being a DJ, you're kind of self-dependent. But now you have to have the team that you have to put and trust and say, okay, you guys got to do this, this, and that.
Yeah.
And you got to do this and that. But you got to trust your team.
Yeah.
So building the team currently.
Events, producing events is no joke, man. You know, I used to own a PR firm with my buddy Gio, who I don't know if you've met Gio run around.
I think he's been around for
war. And, you know, we did small stuff, but we did big stuff too. We did the Best Damn Sports Show, Super Bowl party in Arizona. We did Playboy Mansion events twice a year.
I remember that.
And I remember the first big one we did. I don't remember who brought it up, but someone was like, and what time do you guys, when is the ice truck coming?
Yeah.
And we were like, the ice truck? And they were like, how are you going to supply the ice? You're not going to get bags of ice for 2,000 people. Like, you need an ice truck. And we were like, oh, fuck.
Learning. It's a learning experience.
Yeah.
And you doing the events, too, you kind of know, oh, I didn't know we had to do that.
I didn't
know we had to do this. So that's kind of where the stage I'm in now.
Yeah.
The shows that I'm working currently now, I do like 4 or 5 festivals a year.
Yeah.
That I'm kind of just kind of taking from there, kind of, you know, writing down my notes.
Yeah.
Kind of getting my team together and kind of saying, yeah, at the end of the day, you want your festival to be everything you really want from all these other festivals.
Yeah.
I want to take from the Cali Roots. I want to take from the Island Reggae Festival.
Right.
Put those aspects into what I want to do and make the Feel Good Music Festival one of the, you know, and then at the end of the day, the end goal for that is to have Live Nation just buy it.
For
you know what I mean?
Right.
And keep you on as an advisor for 2 years.
Big money, man.
So and there's definitely money in there, but it's something you're passionate about.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, people do it because they're passionate, and this is something I have passionate. The podcast that we just started recently here.
I was going to ask you, how do you like doing the podcast?
Man, bro. And, you know, just doing this now, it's like we have so much history in your own right that you could talk about, and that's a podcast.
Right.
And, you know, I watch your podcast, and I watch everybody here at the studios, and, you know, I watch the ones that are more popular now, Joe Rogan.
Yeah.
And I kind of watch all the way they do it
and
kind of say, okay, let me take from everybody
and
kind of, like, do it, put it into my own thing. And we're like 8, 9 episodes in now.
That's great.
That I told myself, after 10 episodes, you got to say, okay, either you're going to do this or you're kind of just making it a hobby out of it.
Right.
And I think with the 8 episodes that we've done so far, it caught too much traction.
Yeah.
Like, hey, that's just dope.
Yeah.
I watch that thing all the time. And people come up to you and the artists are like, hey, when can I be on that podcast?
Yeah.
You know, we were just talking about, I was with Marshawn Lynch the other day.
Yeah.
He was like, dude, when am I going to get on that podcast? And I'm like,
Can you imagine?
Crazy.
Can you imagine?
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then now you start to realize, okay, wait, podcasting is better when you have guests like Marshawn Lynch.
Yeah.
And you could always talk with a friend, but it's like you want to have those different avenues.
Sure.
So I told everybody, it's a lifestyle one for me.
Yeah.
It's something that I've lived. You know,
it's
I bring it on my friends.
Great marketing tool.
Great marketing tool. And like, you know, we talked about it. Podcasting is huge.
Yeah.
I'm still just in the stage where it's early for me.
Yeah.
Where like maybe down the line something does come about it as far as a sponsor or something like that.
Yeah, yeah,
because
it'll come. 100% it'll come.
And when I say that, all I got to worry about is the Western Conference podcast.
Right.
Stay passionate about that. Get the guests that I want to be on there.
Yeah.
Be real. And everyone's going to see that genuine and see that organic audience that you're building. And then the big league will start seeing it.
Yeah.
Okay, well, what are your numbers? Because I'm starting to realize everyone's like, what are your numbers? That's the number thing.
Yeah.
And you got to get your numbers up by just being genuine and being organic.
Yeah. And the social media, piggyback on that, you know, because that counts too.
Once you have a social media following, like I've noticed with Twitch, trying to get everybody from Facebook, because I have like 30,000 people on Facebook. You know,
it's
I have
so
like 30,000.
To move them over, right?
To get them that
it's
turnover
so
ratio.
Hard to move them over.
I probably, John, probably got about 8% of my followers.
Which is good.
And that's a lot.
Which is good.
But 8% of my followers that follow me to Twitch, I'm just thinking to myself, what if everyone that followed me on social media
would.
But they're so afraid of
a new
platform.
Are you on TikTok?
I just started getting with TikTok.
TikTok's good.
I put a clip of one of my interviews at the podcast, yeah. And it like blew up.
Yeah.
And I'm like, damn, it's crazy because yeah. You don't know how the algorithms work.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And but Facebook like, Reels, are you Facebook posting on Reels?
So I'm starting to do the Reels now because I didn't know that the Reels are what people are starting to watch.
Right.
So you kind of educate yourself in the social media game.
Yeah.
If you use social media the right way, you can do so much more. You can promote your business. You can promote your podcast. But some of these people are just using TikTok just to do these dances.
Right.
It's like, I'm sitting there like, nah, I need to do these clips. I need to get one from the studios. Hey, guys, let me get this clip real quick.
Yeah.
And that clip's going to go viral. Hey, what's this show?
Right.
Then it's like monkey see, monkey do.
Isn't it amazing how technology has opened up so many doors? Like when we were growing up, you needed a guy in a suit from a network to say, yeah, we'll give you a show.
Exactly.
And now you can just fucking show up in a place like
now
this.
Now you go to YouTube University for a little bit, learn some of the game. Like, I tell you guys right now, when I came to Sticky Paw Studio, I was currently looking for a studio to do exactly what you guys do here. And I was with my business partner. We're looking at like, okay. And it was just an empty shell.
Yeah.
And I'm like, shit, it's going to take, you know, cameras and all this stuff. And it was crazy. I stumbled upon you guys by DJ E-Rock.
Yeah.
A mutual friend of ours, and he was like, hey, I'm doing this podcast at Sticky Paws. I was like, bro, is it cool if I come sit in? I came here, I was like, dude, this is exactly what we're looking for. So I had brought my business partner over here, and he, you know, it's easy to say it, but when they see it, it's kind of like, oh, shit, this is the real deal.
Yeah.
And, you know, you guys were ahead of the curve by building the studio and doing how you guys did it.
Yeah.
And I said, dude, now that people are like, they don't have to build that studio, they can come to something like that that you guys already have built.
Yeah.
And it makes it easier for them where everything is turnkey. Now you just got to be a talent.
Right.
And that's one thing a lot of people that are coming up, if you could just be the talent and not have so many hats in this thing, you'll be better off and the talent will be that much better.
Right.
But if you're like, I'm the sound guy.
You can't wear all the hats.
I'm the producer.
I mean, you can do it, but you shouldn't.
Oh, yeah. I come over here. We got G and Travis producing the show. I'm like, dude, that's gold there.
Yeah.
Like, if I don't have them engineering it and doing all these, you know, the cut angles and making sure we sound good, make sure we don't peak, I was doing that all on my own.
Yeah.
And to have a team do that is like, you know how valuable that is to your brand.
Before you get out of here, this was really fun. Before you get out of here, we must talk about San Francisco Giants versus LA Dodgers.
Okay, so that's...
How do I get you to stop wearing these SF stuff? And like, how do we...
So I'll tell you a funny story about. So I was actually, we were raised in Long Beach, California.
Okay.
My friend, my whole family was Dodger fans. Whole family were Laker fans.
All right. What happened?
So, you know, in Samoan culture, there was like gang activity in Southern California.
Right.
So they were like, you know, there was a SOS, it was like a Crip gangs. So we'd go to school out there in Southern California.
Yeah.
And we'd come home and be like, hey, Dad, these guys want to jump us into a gang. You know, us being young, we're so white. We're like, we're going to go. He said, oh, wait, who's going to jump you into a gang? Oh, these guys were saying we got to be wear these blue rags and everything.
Somebody
was like, shit, I got to get these guys out of here. So as the whole sports thing was going on, I went to Long Beach at one of the parks over there. It was like a basketball camp.
Yeah.
And I told the story before. James Worthy was there, and he was doing the basketball camp. James Worthy, I went to have him sign my basketball. He kind of patted me. He was like, oh, not right now. And kind of walked off on me. So after that, I was like, fuck James Worthy and fuck the Lakers.
Because
we were Showtime Laker fans.
Right.
Same thing happened with Fernando Valenzuela. I'm a young-ass kid.
No.
And I was like, dude. So my dad was like, we're moving to the Bay Area to get away from the gang stuff.
Yeah.
And I was like, dude, as soon as we move to the Bay, I don't want to have nothing to do with the Dodgers. I don't want to have nothing to do with the Lakers.
Damn.
So we moved there. I was a Golden State Warrior fan. I was a San Francisco Giants fan. Uh-huh. We were always with a Niner fan.
Yeah.
But this whole thing where everyone, you know, I see all my family still Dodger and Laker fans.
Yeah.
Oh, Cisco, he sold out. Like, nah. Blame Fernando Valenzuela and James Worthy for that. Because, you know, a lot of these athletes and a lot of these people that are in those positions, I tell them, you never know what impact you're going to have on kids when you don't sign, you know, an autograph. When you don't take a picture.
Right. You're prime their
example,
hero.
Prime example, Scottie Pippen and Future. Future ended was being a kid. He said he wanted to take a picture with Scottie Pippen. He didn't do it. He ended up growing up and fucking Scottie Pippen's wife. Come on.
I did not realize that. Oh, my God. I didn't. George, did you know that story?
I did not know that.
Future wanted to take a picture with Scottie Pippen. Scottie Pippen turned him down. Grew up and said, you know what? I'm going to fuck Scottie Pippen's wife. Ended up. He has a song called I'm Fucking Your Wife in My Gucci Flip Flops, which is about Scottie Pippen's wife.
And that's Larsa? Is that her
name?
Larsa?
Yeah, you know the bad one. You know the basketball wives.
Wow.
So I'm telling you guys, so athletes,
Holy shit.
Anybody in position, make sure you take the time for these kids because they're going to remember this shit.
Better come correct.
Come on. You got to take it. Takes you 1 or 2 seconds to take a picture. Yeah. I posted on my page. I'm a big Niner fan. Deebo Samuel did the same thing to this kid.
Yeah.
And it was, oh, you don't know what the situation was. I was like, yeah, with social media, you don't have to know the situation. He didn't sign his kid's football, and everybody was on him. Oh, you're a piece of shit. But it's like, you don't know the backstory, but that thing now with social media, now it's a viral video.
Yeah.
In 2 seconds, you could have took the sign.
It's
that
2 seconds, no matter what the backstory is, two seconds. Man, this was a fun, more than 2 seconds, whatever this
was. Thank you for having me, John.
Yeah. All right. That's about it, guys. We'll see you next time. I don't know how George ends this show, but he's going to he's gonna do it right now if he knows how to.